This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
December 2018, the hard-traveling fanboys are celebrating Aquaman Month.
Amen.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. Welcome to Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, Vancouver, British Columbia, the L-shaped studios, which are decked with boughs of holly. I am
boughs of holly.
This is
Nicholas. You finally killed her. My God.
It this took is you long Nicholas enough. Brandenburg Duke. Walter the Fourth. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and we are here to bring you week two of Aquaman, aka Aquaman Month, here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Nick, how are you doing on this, the second week of the month of December?
I'm doing pretty well, and I can tell that you're filled with the holiday spirit this week, and that's to be expected given certain events that you participated in. So I'm glad to see that they warmed the cockles of your heart.
That they did, Stevie. That they did, and I am filled with the Christmas spirit, much as you are constantly filled with the Christmas spirits. Correct?
Well, not at the moment, unfortunately. I'm on straight water tonight.
And how appropriate, sir, that you are on strict water tonight, because we are talking about a character who lives and thrives in the water, the king of the seven seas of DC Comics, none other than Arthur Curry, a.k.a. Orin, a.k.a. Aquaman. Are you excited, Nick?
I'm looking forward to it. So excited, I might want to find my favorite aquatic creature and cuddle up to it and see what happens.
See what happens. And just make sure that your stepmother or whatever that you would call that, your adoptive mother doesn't step in and stop it from happening, you know?
Right. And then you have to murder your romantic rival.
Right. Well, what better place to start our discussion for this week?
Yep. Let's talk about that time that Aquaman tried to fuck a dolphin.
Yep. We talked last week about the animated adaptation of Aquaman Throne of Atlantis, and this week we are turning to the first of two Long Book Hunters episodes, where we're going to take a look at a trade paperback collection of Aquaman's greatest adventures, and we are starting things off. Actually, we're going to do a double shot this month of Peter David and his classic run on Aquaman, which, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, neither of us have read before.
No, never.
So we,
even though we are big fans of Peter David here at Place to Be Nation Pop,
absolutely. We even had an event in his honor. Three of them, in fact.
Two of them. He didn't earn the naming rights until the second biennial Place to Be Nation Pop Peter David Memorial Fantasy Comics Draft, presented by what was at that time a hypothetical DC Comics Online Unlimited subscription service.
Now, a hypothetical
non-rotational yes, DC Comics Online Unlimited subscription service.
Yes. So, heavens to Burgatroyd. I've forgotten where I was at.
Peter David.
Peter David, yes. So, we've not encountered any of this. Nick and I are both primarily familiar with Aquaman through the New 52 Geoff Johns run and on through the present day with the current run by Dan Abnett. So a lot of Aquaman's classic traditional stories are unknown to us. So, Nick, is this the earliest Aquaman story that you have read?
I don't know for sure. I'm fairly sure that I read a crossover with Green Lantern at some point during my Green Lantern chronological read, but in terms of a longer form, dedicated Aquaman-focused story, this is probably the earliest I've reached back.
Yeah, same for me. When did you first encounter the character of Aquaman? This is a good chance to talk about
this. Oh, God, I don't even know.
I think the first time for me, probably, oh man, I'm thinking back to the early 90s when I was reading comics regularly. Yeah, he really wasn't a big factor in.
Was he in Marvel versus DC?
I believe he was, yes. He fought Namor.
Yeah, so that would have been my first time then, because like, even though I wasn't reading comics at the time, I read Marvel versus DC when I was a kid. So
yes, so he has a very brief battle with Namor there and defeats him. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it would have been the DC animated universe. I actually did not watch Superman at the time it was on much, but I did encounter Aquaman in his two-part episode on Justice League. Right. Which I believe involved Ocean Master as that the plot of that one. So, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed all of his appearances on Justice League, where he's kind of this bearded warrior king. They even do the hook hand storyline on there. So that's kind of my only encounter with this version of Aquaman. But here we have Peter David in 1993 coming in and taking a character who, had been through quite a number of, I guess, reimaginings over the years. This book came out first. The first issue came out in December 1993, and it's called Aquaman: Time and Tide. This is a four-issue miniseries, actually, that came out that was designed to lead into a brand new solo ongoing series for Aquaman. The first time that Aquaman would have a solo ongoing series since before the Crisis on Infinite Earths, back in the early 70s. Or the mid-70s, I should say. So, pretty much after Death of a Prince, which is a classic storyline in Aquaman's lore, he didn't really have an ongoing solo title for some time. There was an attempted reboot in the mid-80s after Crisis on Infinite Earths in a series in 1986, I believe.
My web.
And that was my Siri going off when I said series. Anyway, 1986 had an attempted relaunch. It ran four issues by Neil Posner. Then we had a few specials here and there, a couple more miniseries. We had Peter David's Atlantis Chronicles in 1990 that kind of reimagined the earliest days of Atlantis and gave a little bit of that mythological background that kind of leads into this story. But this is by and large a modern reimagining of Aquaman's earliest days, earliest adventures, and setting the stage for the characterization and some of the plots that would carry forward into his solo series. So, have I set the table enough here, Nick?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Well, with that being said, let's get right into it. So this is a series that is written by Peter David, who many may know from his work on The Incredible Hulk, on X-Factor, on any number of titles in comics throughout the 80s, 90s, and today. It is drawn, which would have been around this time, and Wildcats Adventures Sourcebook, whatever that is. Mm. So certainly he's not as prolific as some of the other artists that we've encountered in terms of DC work anyway. So let's get cracking on Time and Tide. So the way this works is I mentioned that Peter David wrote something called the Atlantis Chronicles, which is available, by the way, as is this story, on DC Universe, the application that DC has as a rotational, much to our chagrin, online subscription service. Mm-hmm. The Atlantis Chronicles is also available on there. And full disclosure, we considered reviewing the Atlantis Chronicles this month, but it's so many issues and they're so long. Each issue is over 40 pages, I believe, that we just decided we wouldn't have time to do it. And by we, I mean me. So, so we started with Time and Tide. But the premise of this story is it's framed as Arthur Curry, or Orin, as he's known here, is kind of adding to the Atlantis Chronicles. He's taken it upon himself to keep the storytelling alive, the mythology alive of Atlantis, to record the stories of his time for future generations. And so as he's beginning to write his chapters of the Atlantis Chronicles, he's recounting earlier moments in his life, key moments in his life. And in the first chapter, he's recounting the first time he was called a hero. sort of the birth of Aquaman, if you will, when he stopped just being Orin and became Aquaman, or stopped being Arthur Curry and became Aquaman. And this also involves his first meeting with Barry Allen, a.k.a. The Flash, who in current DC continuity at this time was no longer The Flash. He was dead. Wally West was The Flash. But so this is a good way of establishing it as being in the past, that Barry is The Flash. The surface world has not seen Aquaman before, don't know who he is or what he means to do. And this is his first exposure to celebrity, really. And he comes in to help The Flash take down the Trickster. And there's a great little Easter egg line here, by the way, Nick. I don't know if you caught it, where the Trickster says, "It's time for me to do my best Luke Skywalker impression."
Right, I did catch that. Yep, and this would have been around the time that the Flash television show of the early 90s was airing, in which Mark Hamill played the Trickster. So there you are.
Yep, and that was a cute little line. And now, anyway, Barry and Arthur meet for the first time, and Arthur actually saves Barry, and Barry kind of coaxes him into exposing himself to the surface world and taking credit as being a hero of sorts. But we get the first kind of unique characterization of Arthur in that he is very uncomfortable with celebrity. He's very uncomfortable with the entire culture of the surface world. And I thought this was an outstanding opening chapter, Nick. I mean, I think we really have to almost review this chapter by chapter because of the nature of it, as opposed to viewing it as a whole, as we often do on these episodes.
Yeah, and especially because it's told kind of out of chronological order, and each one is kind of focusing on a different incident in Arthur's life than it is, you know, telling one cohesive narrative. It's not like you have cliffhangers from issue to issue.
Right.
So,
this first issue I thought was particularly strong. In fact, it may have been my favorite issue of the four. It's either this one or the second one. And I thought it was really strong. I think instantly this is a characterization of Aquaman that makes him distinct from the other DC heroes of this time. Mm-hmm. I think Barry is written really compellingly, which is something that a lot of writers struggled with before Geoff Johns kind of revamped Barry and frankly added some characteristics of Wally to him. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of writers struggled with writing Barry Allen in a compelling way, and I thought Peter David did it very well here. It's extremely funny also. There's a lot of great jokes in here, a lot of great visual gags. The I went in deep with the Ocean King shirt from the one lady, and the of course the Hollywood agent or whoever he is that's trying to instantly capitalize on Aquaman's popularity. I thought it was a great story about kind of culture shock and some of the things that make Aquaman a compelling hero that give him agency, how quickly he disposes of the Trickster. I thought it was really strong. What did you think of this as an intro to this new version of Aquaman, if you will?
I liked it. I liked it a lot, actually. Like you said, I have not read very much, if any, Barry Allen from this time period. I know periodically they would have him pop up in flashbacks or whatnot, but it's interesting to see the 90s, you know, Barry Allen viewed through a 90s prism. And like you said, Peter David did a pretty good job here. Artistically, I thought it took a little while to get used to.
I agree.
You know,
very of its time.
It's a different style, a style that you don't really see anymore, and you can debate whether or not that's a good thing or not. But eventually I warmed up to it a little bit, even though there were panels here and there throughout the four issues that still kind of would occasionally take me out of the story because of their inconsistency compared to the other panels that had come before or after. But I enjoyed this, and I liked it portraying Arthur as kind of someone who just easily gets fed up with humanity's bullshit and says, "Fuck it, I'm going back. I'm going home." So I enjoyed this.
I figured you would especially enjoy the antisocial aspects of Arthur's characterization.
Yes. I wasn't trying to lure him anywhere. I was trying to let him do whatever the hell he wanted to you.
And I was good, but he wouldn't leave me the hell alone. Now, unless you want to get more of it, you better leave me the hell alone.
It was pretty good,
frankly. I really, really enjoyed this. This is also our first kind of hints that this is a very different version of Aquaman than what you and I are used to, Nick. As you know, we get more of this in the second issue, which we'll touch on in a second. But you and I, Nick, are used to the version of Aquaman that is, I guess, more the Silver Age origin of him, where he is the son of the Lightkeeper, Thomas Curry, and Queen Atlanta of Atlantis.
Say that five times fast.
Exactly. And so he's kind of a quote-unquote half-breed between them, and but has spent much of his time in the surface world. Here, he has spent most of his time underwater in the sea, and now is kind of venturing into the surface world again, exploring his role there, it seems. So very, very interesting stuff here. And again, we're Aquaman novices, so there's a lot of nuance that we miss in terms of his history. All we can go on is what's in this miniseries. But really, really good opening here. And that leads us into the second issue. Same creative team here. And this is actually Arthur recalling his upbringing, essentially, his earliest days on this planet as an infant who was abandoned on Mercy Reef. And this is actually an angle that I believe we saw explored in the animated universe, where Arthur was considered to be cursed by the Atlantean, elders. Mm-hmm. He was considered, because of his blonde hair, he was considered to have a curse that was going to doom Atlantis. And so they took him out to Mercy Reef, and they left him there with the idea that when the tide receded,
see, this is the mistake they made. What they should have done is taken him to Oklahoma with a burlap sack and a hammer,
yep,
and given him to a young Jim Ross and tell him, do what needs to be done, son, and there would be no Arthur Curry to worry about.
No, he'd be done, wouldn't he?
He would.
He would be hammered, and then, well, he'd go back home, and he'd do what he had to do. He learned a lesson. So Arthur is left to die, basically, because they believe that the surface air exposure, once the tide recedes, will kill him. But instead, he thrives. He survives and thrives in the air up there. And eventually, he ends up still as a baby. He's alone, and so he will die eventually if he doesn't get help. And that help comes in a very unusual manner. The help comes in the form of a school of dolphins. And I'm not sure if they're called schools of dolphins, but that's what I'm going to call them here, Nick.
Mm.
And the school of dolphins, one of them in particular, takes pity on young Arthur and saves him in the ocean. And,
a group of dolphins is called a pod, by the way.
A pod of dolphins?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, this pod of dolphins, perhaps from the Miami area, I'm not sure, come in and rescue Aquaman. And the one in particular takes pity on him and kind of raises him as one of her own after convincing the rest of the group to help out this surface looking individual, this non-dolphin. Clearly, he's not a dolphin, you know. So they raise him. They raise Arthur from a young child, and we see his development. And I don't know about you, Nick. I thought this part of the book was outstanding. I mean, as weird and as goofy as it is and it sounds, I thought it was really compelling because I thought it was well written, and I thought the idea of how these animals communicate with each other, and the in particular, I thought this was the strongest artwork in the entire book from this Kirk Jarvinen. I thought his work was very strong here, showing the facial expressions of young Arthur and also the movement of the dolphins and how it portrayed their personalities without having human faces. You know, I thought it was really, really well done.
Yeah, it was good, especially because they did a good job of establishing how much more intelligent the dolphins are than other forms of undersea life, because we get a comedic scene with a group of sharks dealing with Aquaman in the first issue.
Yes,
and they're going to eat
the Flash. Yes.
Yeah, they speak in broken English. They kind of speak in like Hulk speak, essentially, when he's communicating with them, whereas the dolphins have, like, you know, complex emotions and this kind of rigid culture that they adapt to. So even though they don't get a ton of time, I mean, they're probably only in, what, 18 to 20 pages of the of this four issue work, they still do a really good job of establishing how this works and his and Arthur's, you know, bond with his adoptive, I guess, parents, for the lack of a better term. And of course, as we alluded to earlier, let it not be forgotten that young Aquaman tries to fuck a dolphin.
Yes, you see, while he is being raised, he's one of the other young dolphins shows him kindness as he grows up. Her name is Neera, appropriately enough, Nick, only one letter removed from his future wife. And I wonder if there's some sort of Freudian reason for that. Mm. But in any event, she takes great pity on him, and they become friends over time. And Arthur develops a love for her, perhaps an unrequited love, but a love nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And eventually, Arthur, who believes himself to just be a badly mutated dolphin, because remember, all he's known his whole life are these animals that have raised him. So he believes himself to be one of them, just a mutated version. Mm-hmm. And so he
– I ain't got no mirrors under the sea.
That's right. And so he's trying to seduce, I guess, or move in on this Neera individual, and he is rebuffed by her current lover at the time, this other dolphin, and then further rebuffed by his own mother, who tells him in no uncertain terms that he cannot fornicate with this dolphin.
You can't do it.
She's not for you. He physically cannot do it. And
I mean, he probably could try.
He could try, but I mean, it wouldn't. Certainly, they could not bear any heirs, you know.
Well, you don't know. He's half Atlantean. We don't know what they have going on down there.
We don't know. Maybe. That's true. And this is very devastating to Arthur. He doesn't understand why he can't be with her, and he's not interested in exploring the surface world as his mother urges him to do. He doesn't want anything to do with them because they're callous and mean and weird.
Ugly. Even though they just eliminated his main romantic rival for him, as he conveniently led his rival into the blades of a giant fishing boat and killed him.
Yeah, and then he tries to, and this is also a great part of the story because this shows that Arthur, even though he's been raised under the sea, can't get rid of that humanity in him because. His way of reacting to the death of his rival is completely different from how the other dolphins react. Whereas they may be sad, they have a way of doing things. And Arthur reacts in that most base of human emotions of, I have to save him. And then when he accepts that he can't save him, he reacts with anger and a desire to keep him alive at all costs. This is not the natural way of things. And so Arthur finally accepts that he is not a dolphin and he has to do his own thing, and that no matter how much he tries, he can't be a part of their culture because he's just too different. And I thought that was a really powerful lesson for him, and there's a really powerful scene where he hugs his mother goodbye and takes off to explore, to sow his royal oats, you might say. But I again, another great issue here. And was that guy on the boat supposed to be Thomas Curry? Because that's kind of what I assumed.
I don't know. Like I wasn't sure what that was supposed to, if he was supposed to be or not. It didn't really feel like there was any connection to the story. That's one thing we should mention is while this is retelling aspects of Aquaman's origin, it's not really telling the entire thing, because there are some massive gaps here. And so I'm not entirely sure, because you and I aren't Aquaman aficionados, we don't know what those gaps are supposed to be. You know what I mean?
Right, yes. So I don't know how much of this was sort of rebooting his origin or how much of this was just filling in different blanks that were going to be new areas to explore moving forward. Yeah, that's a great point, because we don't know how much of this was already established canon. We don't know what the status was of Thomas Curry post-crisis. But there was a character that kind of I thought was supposed to kind of play that role, and I was expecting to see more of him and never really did, because he seemed to be one of the few actual good people that we meet here who is not relishing the destruction of the sea life, as many humans do. But yeah, I thought this was an outstanding issue overall, and a great again continuing this great look at a segment of Aquaman's past.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well, for sure. It gives you a little bit look at his adolescence, and kind of it's a different take than we're accustomed to. Like, we're accustomed to him
totally
growing up with this deep connection to the surface world and with a very positive relationship with his father that he eventually loses, and that kind of sets him off on this path to becoming Aquaman. And here we don't have any of that, and yet it's still captivating in a certain way. It's different, but not the bad kind of different, I would say.
Agreed. And it kind of sets the tone, I think, for what I do remember of the Peter David version of Aquaman from Justice League books of that time, which is a very kind of grizzled, almost perpetually angry Aquaman, where he's coming at it from a part. He has a darkness in him that he can't get rid of, a lingering resentment for life in some ways, because he's somebody that's never really had a real family. He's never really – everyone he's ever loved has left him or died, and he's just – you know, he's got a lot to resent about the world, both the surface world and the world of Atlantis. So that leads us into issue 3, which is a story of his first real love and mm-hmm. his first – extended experience, not first, because it says that he had been living with the lightkeeper, the lighthouse keeper, Thomas Curry, for a while, but we don't ever see him in the story. But this is kind of, he comes out of exile and he moves to Alaska, or at least that area, and encounters the Inupiat people, who are the natives there, and it kind of tells the story of him encountering a group of people that view him as an outsider, mm-hmm. who don't want him to be a part of their world because of what he represents. But he's taken in by these people.
He's a white man.
He's shown kindness, and he ends up falling in love mm-hmm. with one of the what is her bloody name? I just read it. He ends up falling in love with
the heavy-chested Eskimo lady.
Yes, an Eskimo lady who is drawn in the most 90s way yes. possibly yes. imagined.
She has Captain America-like breasts here.
Captain America-like breasts and a gigantic ass.
Yes.
She seduces Arthur in the snow.
Yep.
And they make whoopee, Nick.
They make whoopee. But it's seen, unfortunately, by someone else from the Inupiat people, the mysterious Orm. And at this point, I am thoroughly confused as to how this origin relates to any of the other versions of Aquaman that I am familiar with.
Yes. You see here, Orm is actually one of these Inupiat people. He is, yes. he is in an ancillary way related to Keiko and yet wants to bed her.
Yes.
And he also
sometimes you got to keep it in the family. You know, that's just the way it goes.
That's right. The family that lays together stays together.
That's right. That's right.
So
you got to make sure your family tree is unforked in certain places.
That's right. Hey, we do live in Alabama, so
we do.
Anyway, so Keiko and Arthur take to one another. Keiko and her family are kind of traditionalists.
Yes.
They are rooted in the old world. They fish with their spears. They live in igloos. They don't want to.
They live in what?
Well, I guess they don't. They had moved beyond the igloos at this point.
The igloos. I love it. That's an interesting way to pronounce that word. I like it. Igloos.
Igloos? Is that better?
Igloos. Yeah. The igloos. That was a David Sunday like pronunciation.
Well, I don't know what to say to that, except that, you know, one of the most popular bands in Alaska is Pearl Jam.
And what about Aerosmith?
So, no, they're not popular there.
Oh. Mm. Well, yab dab, dabba dabba doobie.
Dabba dabba doobie.
Mm-hmm.
Orm, on the other hand, has forsaken the old world, and he has moved his mother and father into the modern world, and he's making money with his advanced fishing techniques and whatnot, and he's rubbing that modern world into the old people that don't want to move on. And so we know enough about Orm to know that he's an unpleasant individual. He resents the old world and has a very adversarial relationship with his mother, including threatening her with a knife at one point.
What was the deal with his dad? Because, like, there's that thing where his dad is literally in front of the television. Is the implication that he put his dad into, like, a catatonic state somehow?
Yeah, it looks like his dad's in a catatonic state of some kind, and his mother blames him for it, but he doesn't know why his mother blames him for it.
Right.
He says later on in the next chapter that his father was an alcoholic, but I'm not exactly sure what the reality of the situation is. Perhaps that's explored later on in the ongoing run. But so Orm's a nasty little character, and Orm decides when he comes back to visit his family, he sees Arthur laying in the snow naked with Keiko, and he becomes infuriated, and he injures Keiko in a severe manner, and this is all taking part in addition to these recurring dreams that Arthur is having, where he is struggling against a mythological type creature called, see if I can pronounce this right, Nick, Nulyajuk.
Sure.
Nulyajuk is a this purple feminine deity of sorts, underseas deity, and she appears to be at first I thought she was a figment of Arthur's imagination, but it becomes apparent by the end of this chapter that she's real. And that he is having an encounter with her in his mind or in his subconscious somehow. And this actually, without spoiling it completely, plays a factor in what happens with Keiko and her family later on. Apparently this is a well-known older mythological underwater deity. And she is very much feared by the Inupiat people. So this leads to a clear setup for something to come later on, I'm sure, in the ongoing run. She flat out says she's not done with Arthur yet. And so that will definitely play a factor later on. And as a result of everything that happens, Arthur, you know, has to leave his love behind and leave this life that he was kind of making for himself behind. Another example of him losing someone that he loves from his life. But all that being said, I thought this was probably the weakest chapter of the four. What did you think, Nick?
Oh, I think I would probably...
I still liked it.
I think I would edge towards this one being stronger than the last chapter, honestly.
Perhaps.
You know, just because there was so much going on in that last chapter that, like, it's such a massive jump from where he is at the end of chapter 3 to where he is at the end of chapter 4 that for someone mm-hmm. who's not well-versed in Aquaman history, I was very lost during that last chapter trying to figure out how it all fit together and what exactly was going on. And honestly, I probably enjoyed this just as much as the Dolphin issue. Like I like this issue a great deal, actually. I'd probably go second or so on this one. I'd have it above the Barry Allen issue and right there with the Dolphin stuff.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool perspective there. I'm trying to figure out what I didn't like about it. I thought that this was the first issue in which I started to have a few issues with some of the panels that were a little
yes. Now that's one good point is like panels would look drastically different from one another to me anyway,
yes.
from page to page, and like not every panel. It would be like one panel out of like every seven
right.
or eight. And but when you
it
saw
it,
it would
like
really
it was
jump.
Out of a comic strip,
right? Yeah, it would. It was like the art style had changed entirely because most of the time he had very like sharp edges and like sharp mm-hmm. lines and angles to a lot of his characters and designs. And then occasionally you would get these really weird like soft rounded edges to characters,
yep.
and it really didn't look like the same artist at all. It made me wonder if like somebody else had been behind and retouched it, or if it was being done for some sort of intentional effect. But it wasn't like. It would be the same scene, but just a different panel. It wasn't like it was a flashback or anything that would have made sense to differentiate you know, have a differentiation of art styles. It was very off-putting. I'll agree with you there. I guess I was just more into the story probably of it than you were.
Yeah, the story was good. No, I liked the story. I think the only part of the story I didn't like was I did not dig those parts that I talked about that were taking place, I guess, in a subconscious or wherever that was taking place, because those kind of threw me off a little bit, I guess.
Right.
But still, good stuff overall. The writing continued to be great. The dialogue was great. The comedy, when it was there, was really good. And again, great job of setting up this characterization of Aquaman. But yeah, what you talked about, that inconsistency of panels, I thought manifested itself the most in the last issue.
Yes,
here.
I would agree.
There were panels here that looked like it was out of a Looney Tunes comic, with characters with giant eyes and rounded features, and almost like someone was drawing a caricature of them, you know? And then there were other panels where it looked the same as the first three issues. So, again, like you, I don't know if this was intentional. I didn't take it to be that. It felt jarring and out of place at times. And to your point, it kind of took me out of the story at times, which is a shame because I don't really like this issue. This was Arthur remembering his very first encounter with Ocean Master and kind of his initial underestimation of Ocean Master, and also the ramifications of some of his encounters with him later on.
I did not understand, like, I guess they eventually revealed that the half-brother angle here comes from the fact that it's revealed that his father had sex with one of the Inuit, or the Eskimo people, and yeah, it was just, it's so different from the familial relationship that we know in the modern context of them being both sons of Atlanta, just with different fathers, like, you know, Arthur being the love that she couldn't hold on to, the love for the Currys and stuff. But this was a really weird version of Ocean Master that kind of comes off like a buffoon, honestly. Like, Aquaman punks him out entirely in his first appearance in Atlantis, and then basically outsmarts him and takes him down in his second appearance there on the sub. It was not a great way to introduce Ocean Master as anything more than a bumbling idiot, in my view. Anyway.
I would agree with that. I definitely, and maybe that was the idea, I don't know, but Arthur is writing with a great deal of dread regarding Ocean Master.
But why?
About,
I guess, because of the prophecy that's involved at the end, right?
Right, because there's this prophecy that he'll constantly be at war with his half-brother. And I like the prophecy angle, but like you, I'm not a big fan of the change to – or not the change, I shouldn't say that. But I'm not a big fan of this version of Ocean Master in general. I think it kind of it weakens his connection to Arthur a little bit. And I also was not a big fan of, to your point, having him be such a colossal failure right out of the gate. Because like you said, he gets the shit kicked out of him by Arthur and – publicly humiliated and embarrassed his first appearance, comes back, claims to have learned his lesson, but spends so much time monologuing, and Arthur even pretty much writes this in his journal that he couldn't understand why Ocean Master was sitting there wasting so much time running his mouth, and then the moment that Orm reveals his ties to Arthur, that he was the one that hurt Keiko all those years ago, Arthur easily breaks out of his bonds and then easily takes him down. So, yeah, not a great job of setting up a big bad for the future, unless the idea was to establish him as kind of a lesser villain that would not be that, you know, that dangerous of a threat going forward. I don't know.
And I would assume that he plays a larger role in the Peter David run going forward, being that the prophecy there is introduced near the end and stuff. So, I don't know. I'm interested to see, you know, I don't think we'll get to it on our next episode, but, you know, I'm interested to see what, find out what comes of that. I may do some Googling later on.
Yeah, definitely. And, so that's kind of the story as a whole. It's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit all over the place time-wise, because that's the nature of it. But overall, even with, I did think that it lost a little steam towards the end. I would agree with you on that. As the book goes along, it kind of loses just a little bit of steam, but overall, I still thought this was excellent. Like, as a crash course in Aquaman, I thought this was really good, really effective. And I really – it's different, but still a very interesting take on Aquaman. Not one that was as jarringly boring or disinteresting or uninteresting, I should say, as I was expecting it perhaps to be compared to the modern comics. I thought it was – different in a way that was exciting and interesting.
Yeah, different enough that you're not. It doesn't feel like a rehash to us. Like, doesn't feel like treading over the same ground that we've already seen before in other places. So different enough to keep me engaged. Like we said, the art's a little hit or miss, but overall, I thought all the issues were relatively well plotted, except for maybe the fourth one. I'd give it a pretty solid thumbs up here.
Yeah, I would too. I think if you have a DC Universe subscription, you should absolutely check out these four issues. If you don't, you can also find this on Hoopla in the Peter David Aquaman collection. You can go to your local comic shop, and they may have this old trade sitting around, or they may have the newly collected trade.
Yeah, because this is actually the first four issues. If you go buy Aquaman by Peter David Book 1, which has recently been reissued, I think, within the last year or so to get ready people ready for the movie and also to, you know, celebrate the Peter David run, which is one of the more iconic runs in the character's history. This is actually the first four issues that are printed in that trade. And I guess we can go ahead and say now, so for next week we will be reviewing, in theory, the next eight issues of that trade, which are Aquaman 1 through 8 that kick off his run. So we are hoping to bring to you the entire Peter David Book 1 trade review split across 2 weeks.
That's right. It's the Peter David Memorial, mm-hmm. Greg Phillips Killing Edition of the Long Book Hunters.
Hey, if those next issues read as fast as these did, this should not take you very much time. That's one thing I'll say. This was a brisk read. I read it in one session, and it wasn't brisk because I was skimming. It was just – it kept me engaged, and I kind of a page turner, so I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Very, very quick and efficient writing here. Much faster read than some of our Long Book Hunter assignments.
Certain assignments that we don't have to say the name of.
We don't have to say the names of right now. And you know what the best part was of this book, Nick?
What's that?
No Morgan Le Fay.
No Morgan Le Fay. No one said perish forbid. Oh, man. It was awesome.
That was great. Anyway, so what are your thoughts on Aquaman Time and Tide? Is this a book that you remember reading years ago? Is it one you've always wanted to get to? Give us your thoughts. Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Comment on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Send us an email, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Let us know your thoughts on this book. Let us know your thoughts on Peter David's Aquaman run. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit of the backstory here, the history of Aquaman and his many reboots. From what I understand, Nick, Aquaman has a much more convoluted history than I even realized, in terms of they've kind of tweaked his story pretty continuously from the Golden Age through today, with a lot of variety and a lot of wildly different takes on how he becomes who he becomes.
Yeah, that's my understanding now as well. I had been laboring under the delusion that it had always been the childhood at the lighthouse with Arthur Curry as his biological father, but apparently not.
Well,
Tom Curry, not Arthur Curry.
In any event, we will return next week with a more in-depth look at the Peter David solo Aquaman series from the 90s. And until then, we're going to take a break, and we hope you stick with us, because when we come back, we've got the rundown of all the news and notes in the comic book world, and we will have our thoughts on the almost mid-season finales of several of the DC CW shows, and all of that is right around the corner.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTBN Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post-Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Listeners, thank you so much for sticking around with us. We hope to reward your patience and your loyalty with a really strong back half of the show. And if there's one thing that can be said about Nick Duke, it's that he's got one strong backside.
I do. That's true. That's an accurate statement.
Well, we're going to get started on this portion of the show by talking about the news and notes of the comic book world. It's a little segment that you know and love as The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
Tony, tell me a little bit about Avengers and the Avengers 4.
Well, Conrad, I don't know much about it.
Well, as it turns out, Tony, hi, I'm Greg again. Good to be back here. As it turns out, the much-anticipated sequel to Avengers Infinity War has gotten its official title and its official release date and an official teaser trailer.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start off with the first part there. Its title is Avengers Endgame.
Mm.
That's Avengers colon Endgame.
Yes.
And as someone who is very well acquainted with an Endgame for my colon from the weekend, I would like to also mention that the new release date for Endgame will be April 26th, a week earlier than previously announced.
Mm.
And then finally, let's just talk about it, Nick. That trailer, the teaser trailer, not really a full-length trailer, just the teaser trailer.
You know, it's interesting because I'm of two minds about this trailer. I love it. On one of my minds loves it, and the other one doesn't. And let me tell you why. I do not, after watching that trailer, I don't want to see the movie any more than I wanted to see it previously. My anticipation level is the exact same. So, like, and there was nothing in the trailer that made me go, oh, holy shit, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, if you compare it to every other movie trailer or comic book movie trailer that's come out in the last 5 years, 5 to 10 years, it doesn't compare. So my one mind about it is somewhat disappointed. However, my more prominent mind loves the trailer for exactly that reason. The fact that it doesn't show anything, doesn't tell us anything, and is going to make us wait for the movie. It is revealing nothing. Other than a shot of Hawkeye as Ronan, or of Clint Barton as Ronan, there's nothing revealed in this trailer.
Yes, and as someone who knows absolutely nothing about Ronin, that meant nothing to me. But I did love the part at the beginning of the trailer with Tony floating in space about to die, recording one last message for Pepper. I thought that was very appropriately emotional and affecting. And honestly, emotion was all I was looking for from this trailer. I just wanted a feeling. I didn't want to know anything about the plot. I didn't want to know anything about the plan. I didn't want to know anything about anything. I just wanted a feeling. The only real revelation in this trailer is that Scott Lang has somehow escaped his predicament from the end of Ant-Man and the Wasp and is apparently going to be a huge factor in helping the heroes fight Thanos. So that was the only real reveal in this trailer, but I liked it. That's exactly what I wanted from it. I didn't want anything major. I didn't want to see a new character reveal. I didn't want to see – I'm going to see this movie regardless. And I approach this the same way that I approach Star Wars trailers. I don't want any plot information. I just want the title. I want the music. I want shots of things happening, and that's it.
Right.
I don't want anything that will in any way give anything significant away about the movie. It reminds me, Nick, of the Dark Knight Rises trailers.
Yes, yes.
Very bare bones, very little revealed about the plot, and that's fine by me.
Yep. I agree. I'm with you on that. It's just we have gotten so far away from that in pretty much every instance of a movie that's going to be heavily marketed the way this one is that I wasn't expecting it. I'm glad we got it, but I was not expecting it.
Right, I would agree. Well, come on over, Nick. Come on. Get over here to this corner. Let's get into the worlds of DCEU corner.
The worlds of DCEU, I like it.
Because a report surfaced this week from, appropriately enough, The Hollywood Reporter. Now, I don't know if that's Hollywood Hulk Hogan. I don't know if that's Marquise Hollywood Brown. I don't know if that's – I don't know who that is, Nick. But what I do know is that Warner Brothers is developing a Plastic Man or Plastic Men, if you will.
Allegedly.
Film with screenwriter Amanda Idoko. And – of course, everyone knows Plastic Man is Eel O'Brien, a small-time crook who becomes a hero with shape-shifting powers after being doused in strange chemicals, a recurring theme for comic book characters. Most people know Plastic Man less for his personality – or for his character, I guess you would say, in terms of his plot details, and more for his general personality, which is a straight-up comedy character, one of the funniest characters in – the DC Universe. So it would stand to reason that this would be a comedy. Now, all of that is with the assumption that it actually happens, which now, Nick, given your and my trepidation and general pessimism about all DC announced projects and film, I'm assuming that you are also, as well as I am, expecting this not to happen.
Yeah, I am as well. That's true. I'm not expecting any DC movie to happen until, like, I see actual footage from it. That's kind of where I am. Like, you know, Wonder Woman 2 is probably the only example, or Wonder Woman 1984, excuse me. I know that's happening. I know Aquaman's happening. I know Shazam's happening. I know that fucking Joker movie is happening. And other than that, I'm not expecting any of them to get made, because it seems like everything they try to do gets caught up in development hell. So, no, I have no actual belief that this will happen. Maybe I'll be pleasantly surprised. But then again, maybe I won't. Maybe it will happen and it'll suck. So I don't know.
Or what if it happens and it's good?
Well, they'll have to prove that they can make good movies consistently before I'll buy into that.
Well, we're not done in the DCEU corner, Nick. Sorry, the worlds of DCEU corner. Because more news has come out about Birds of Prey, open parentheses, and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, in parentheses. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Sharp Objects actor Chris Messina has been cast as a classic Batman villain, Victor Zsasz.
I know you're excited about this. You love the character of Victor Zsasz.
I love Victor Zsasz. Zaz is a serial killer character, and his gimmick is that he carves marks on his body for every one of his victims, and he's covered from head to toe in these marks that are counting up all of his victims. He has been a villain in a few great Batman stories. He was in Nightfall.
Is your apartment being haunted currently?
You mean our studio?
Yes. Is your side of the studio being haunted currently?
Why? What do you hear?
I heard a ghostly noise in the background of your side of the session.
I wouldn't discount it.
Mm.
I wouldn't discount it. But so Zaz has been in a few great Batman stories over the years. He's in Nightfall. He's in he's the lead villain in a miniseries from the early 90s, or a story arc in the early 90s. The name of which I've forgotten right now, even though I had it as a kid and loved it. So anyhow. Zaz is a great villain. He's not great on Gotham, so don't look at that version. But I'm looking forward to this, at least what they do with him. I hope they make him more interesting than he was in his Gotham iteration.
Yeah, I would hope so as well. The only other incarnation he'd have to compete with would be the Batman Begins version, which was admittedly a bit role in a very early version of Zaz. So, yeah, right. I'm interested to see where they go with this.
Totally. And he's a character that I don't think has really been used well in the better part of 15, 20 years. So hopefully they'll find out a role to use him in that will work. And with that, that brings an end to the DCEU corner, Nick. So let's stroll back over to the non-haunted area of our studio.
Indeed. Let's do that.
We do have a little more news from the world of Hollywood, of course. That is that the terrific writer of Saga, Brian K. Vaughan,
mm-hmm.
had a huge announcement this week, and that is that he has signed a, quote, overall development deal, end quote, with Legendary Television Studios to adapt several of his creator-owned works into TV series and films.
Mm-hmm.
Vaughn is currently an executive producer on FX's adaptation of Why the Last Man, which is in development, mm-hmm. Serves as an executive consultant on Hulu's Runaways, which is based on the Marvel Comics series that he co-created, mm-hmm. and he was also a writer on Lost.
Indeed he was.
Vaughn will also work with Legendary to develop original properties.
Mm-hmm.
No word on the specific adaptations that will be included in this deal. So there's no guarantee that we will even get a Saga TV series out of this. But boy, I hope we do.
I could easily see Saga becoming like the next big cult HBO show. You know, like that
yes.
massive, like, mm-hmm. you know, science fiction, nerd culture crossover appeal show. Like,
there's no reason it can't take the place of Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones, which they're going to try to replace Game of Thrones with four more Game of Thrones series, but that's neither here nor there. This needs to be on a network that can afford to invest in the special effects budget and get mm-hmm. top-notch talent to play these characters. A Saga television show is a no-brainer, regardless of what he said in the past about not wanting to adapt it. It's tailor-made, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And while this only includes his creator-owned work, obviously, certainly I would hope to see other of his works get developed later on, some of his great writing on a litany of properties. You know, we're going to get Why the Last Man. Hopefully that'll turn out good. He's had such a long and storied career at this point that I'd like to see some – his stories are kind of cinematic in nature anyway. So I'd really like to see how they all play out. But Saga is kind of the one that I'm most excited about for the same reasons I think you are, which is that it can be an HBO or Showtime or something like that series, so long as it has a great budget to it. And the other one is Ex Machina, which is kind of more of a political-based drama, which is owned by DC. It was a Vertigo book, I believe. But I would love to see that one get adapted maybe through a production deal with him as well. So,
yeah, I'm assuming that the only ones that would be part of this deal with Legendary would be the ones he owns himself. I would assume that
right,
Warner's
correct.
Would maintain control over those works that he did for Vertigo. So
that is indeed correct. So yeah, exciting news all around. News, all PN news all around. Also, we have finally gotten an official start date for Punisher Season 2.
Yes.
That date, of course, being January 2019.
Yes.
We will be getting the second and presumably final season of Netflix's Daredevil. Your thoughts, Nick?
The Punisher, you mean?
The Punisher, sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm pumped. I loved Punisher Season 1. I have been on the record on this podcast numerous times with my effusive praise for Punisher Season 1. I can't wait to see what they do with Season 2. And I am a little bit sad that it's likely the last Punisher season, but take what we can get while we can get it.
Well, one place that you're not likely to see the Punisher anytime soon, at least this version of the Punisher.
I see what you did there.
Is on the Disney Plus service. A report surfaced from Deadline that the Netflix characters are locked in due to a 2-year clause in the original 2013 agreement with Netflix. According to the Hollywood Trade, the characters that debuted in the shows, as well as the shows themselves, are effectively mothballed from any non-Netflix projects for 2 years from the date of their cancellation. That would mean 2020 for Iron Fist, Daredevil, and Luke Cage before they could appear on any other network. Now, interestingly enough, though, this article does say that the Punisher was not part of that agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And so no one is really sure what the status of the Punisher would be in this situation.
And my assumption is, has always been, that the likelihood of these shows crossing over and carrying on Disney Plus was slim anyway. Disney Plus has said they want to be an all-ages streaming service. They're not going to house a ton of mature-themed content the way these shows were marketed. Now, could you conceivably do a continuation that tones down some of the violence and sexuality of these shows? Sure, you could.
Not for the Punisher.
Not for the Punisher, right. I'm talking about the larger universe. You could, but it wouldn't really be true and in keeping with these versions of the characters that you've told so far. So I would think a recasting and a complete reboot of these characters would be much more likely than direct continuations anyway. So this just sucks because it means you can't go straight to work on, say, a new Jessica Jones or a new Daredevil that's unrelated for 2 years because the characters themselves are held up in this deal.
Well, over on the DC side of things, we got a major casting announcement for another DCU series. This is the upcoming Swamp Thing series that is expected to come in August of 2019. And Beverly Hills 90210 alumnus Ian Ziering, best known for playing Steve Sanders on that show, also known for being in the Sharknado movies, has been cast as Blue Devil, a magical character in the DC pantheon who has made prominent appearances in everything from the various crises to Zero Hour and everything in between. So for those who don't know who Blue Devil is, Daniel Cassidy was a stuntman turned movie star and becomes semi-famous after playing the demonic Blue Devil. And he is on a collision course with Destiny. This is actually his TV show description. In the comics, he was a stuntman who designed a practical effects bodysuit for a Blue Devil movie. While wearing the suit on set, a demon was accidentally summoned and blasted Cassidy with a spell that permanently bonded the stuntman with the suit. He was later transformed into an actual demon by Neron, who was a recurring villain in the 90s. So I'm excited about this, Nick. I love me some Steve Sanders. I love me some Ian Ziering. I love me some Blue Devil. What's not to love?
I don't give a shit about 90210 and thus about Ian Ziering. I don't know anything about Blue Devil. This is a story that's just for you, sir.
You've encountered Blue Devil before, though, because because he was in the Days of Vengeance.
Yes, I have encountered him before, but that's all. That's literally probably the only thing I've encountered him in is that Infinite Crisis tie-in.
Do you know anything about Joel McHale, Nick?
Well, I know that he did The Soup.
He did. And he also did the series Community.
Community, which I haven't seen.
Well, he has also been cast in the DC Universe. Anyway, Joel McHale has been cast as, here's a name you've heard a lot on our show, Starman in DC Universe's Stargirl live-action series. However, he is not playing Jack Knight, nor is he playing Ted Knight. He is reportedly playing Sylvester Pemberton, who in the comics was the Star-Spangled Kid and Skyman and turned down the offer to become Starman. However, the Hollywood Trade describes him as the Golden Age Starman. The description of the character says, "A courageous and confident superhero, Starman is a member of the Justice Society of America. He wields a mysterious anti-gravity weapon called the Cosmic Staff and has a longtime sidekick named Stripesy, who is better known as Courtney Whitmore's stepfather, Pat Dugan." I do think that it's possible that there's a mix-up here and that he's not actually playing Sylvester Pemberton, or that they're changing Sylvester Pemberton's
character. How great of a name is Sylvester Pemberton, by the way?
It's pretty great, Nick. It's pretty great.
I hope they leave it. It's Sylvester Pemberton.
The Star-Spangled Kid. I remember him from the comics, from encountering them. So it sounds like this is kind of going with that legacy aspect of the JSA, where it's a second generation of heroes, perhaps, who are trying to pick up the mantle of their forefathers. But we'll see if that's true or not. Regardless, Joel McHale's a funny guy, and this is a pretty fun casting announcement here.
Yeah, it is, although I would assume that, you know, like I said, like you alluded to, Joel McHale, I would have thought, you know, Jack Knight more than anybody else.
Yes.
A more comedic take, but
right.
If he's going to play the straight man mentor type character, let's see how it goes. Let's just let it play out and see where it goes.
Mentor, you say? Is that like your mentor, Bobby Pierce?
My mentor, Bobby Pierce, yep. He said it is what it is.
He did say that, Nick. Mm-hmm. He did indeed.
He also said I was the greatest baseball player he'd ever seen.
Yeah, he said that if it wasn't for his knee injury, for your knee injury, that you could have walked onto the team and started at all nine positions.
Mm-hmm. And then he let me walk up and slap the athletic director right in the fucking face.
Right in the face, and call him a thunder cunt.
I'm thunder cunt. Yeah, Lord.
We knew that person.
You knew that person.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you encountered him.
Once, like twice maybe.
You were the one that told me the famous paragraph story.
Yes, we need a paragraph above it explaining what it is. Even though it was literally, there was literally a paragraph above it explaining what it is. No one cares about what we're talking about right now.
How is that different from the rest of our show?
A solid point, sir.
Rocky Johnson noise.
Little Richard noise.
All right, let's get this over with, Nick. So for some time here on Hard Traveling Fanboys, and that some time being since the beginning of our show in 2016,
literally for years, like for – when did the last one come out? 2008?
Something like that, long time ago.
Been a while. Been a minute.
A long effing time. We have been singing the praises –
2009.
We have been singing the praises of Marvel Ultimate Alliance and Marvel Ultimate Alliance TU, the tag team action adventure RPG games that Marvel put out when we were in college, basically, that were just the most fun multiplayer games in the world. Mm-hmm. Just set up a console, have three friends come over, each of you pick a great Marvel character and play through some of the most fun levels and fun stories you can imagine. Great team-up moves, incredibly innovative engine at the time, or at least fun engine at the time, And they sat on it for so long, I think we both just kind of assumed it was never going to happen again. Well, this week we got the announcement we've been waiting for.
We sure did. Marvel
Ultimate Alliance 3, The Black Order, is officially coming out. And I think that's the end of the story, Nick.
I'm so excited about it. It appears, based on the little bit of a cinematic trailer that was shown, to be involving a hunt for the Infinity Stones, and seeing them wind up in some interesting hands. At one point, there's a shot in the trailer of the Green Goblin holding an Infinity Stone, which looks awesome.
We've got some of the characters that are shown in the picture here that have not been in prior Marvel Ultimate Alliance games include the Guardians of the Galaxy. We see Star-Lord, Rocket Raccoon. We see Drax. I believe Gamora as well.
Groot.
And we also see Groot. I don't see Groot.
Well, he was in the
trailer.
Yeah.
And then also here is the dog from the Inhumans.
Lockjaw.
And then, of course, your classic array of prior appearing characters. So, and probably more that we don't even know about yet, because I'm sure this is going to be a much bigger roster than what's on this picture here. So, very exciting announcement, Nick.
It is very exciting, and I can't wait for us to be able to play it online together. I mean, aren't you excited about that as well?
I'm really excited about, you know, I got a PS4 over the summer for the purposes of Red Dead Redemption 2, really enjoy the system. It's doing really good for me so far. Great picture, great sound, great apps and everything. And I'm really looking forward to playing Ultimate Alliance with you on it.
Yeah. Now, wouldn't it be a shame if for some reason you weren't able to do that?
Well, that would be a shame, Nick. But, I mean, why would they want to limit their sales? Why would they want to go to exclusive to another system and exclude the PlayStation? They wouldn't do that.
Well, God, that argument can be made for any game. Why would Spider-Man want to do that and exclude the Xbox One or the Nintendo Switch?
Oh, what are you saying, Nick, about the Nintendo Switch?
I'm saying that Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3 is going to be the exclusive property of the Nintendo Switch upon its release.
What?
That's right. So
Ted Ginn Jr.
Which is fine, because, you know, our foursome was already full. We didn't have a spot for you anyway. Jeremy and Sam and Russell and I will enjoy our quartet, and you will be on the outside looking in, my friend.
As always.
Yeah.
I can only look from afar. I'm going to be like Wolverine laying on the bed stroking the picture, but it's going to be Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3 on the picture.
It's going to be a copy of Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3. You'll just have the game. You won't have the system. You'll just stroke
it. I'll just buy the game just to support the concept of the game existing.
In all honesty, I would be surprised if it's not a window of exclusivity that doesn't eventually end and see the game come to other systems. I think that's the way it'll go, but I don't know. We'll see.
Maybe by then we'll actually have cross-system compatibility.
Now, see, that would be awesome.
That's a bit of a bummer, because when it does finally come out, no one will want to play it with me because I'll have it on another system. But nonetheless, the game is awesome. It's going to be awesome. There's no way it won't be. The other two are great.
Now, granted, we must note it's not being done by Activision the way the first two were.
Oh, that's true. I just read that. It's being done by Koei Tecmo Games / Team Ninja.
Yeah, it's a little bit of...
Published by Nintendo.
Yeah,
so
it's going to be a different... a little bit of a different
vibe.
Setup. So I just hope they don't change too much. We really just want the first two done, or more specifically, the first one done all over again.
We're not interested in an evolution of gameplay.
No. I don't even really care if you evolve the graphics. Just, I need more of it to play.
Right. I've started replaying through the first one on the PS4, and have been having a good time with that, although it would be better with other people. But it's been fun just to kind of screw around on there once in a while and bring back old memories, you know? Well, that's it for the rundown. The rundown is over. There is no more rundown, Nick.
Nope.
And that means that it's time for us to take a look at what we've been reading and watching.
Watching. Now, you're going to have to help me out here. I'm in the position that you are, whereas I watched ahead, and so I'm crossing streams here and getting mixed up on some things. So,
I'm going to try my best on that, Nick, because here's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I am still about 4 episodes behind on Supergirl.
All right, well, Supergirl is part of the crossover, so we're not even going to address that this week, this episode of Supergirl that we would be reviewing, so no worries there. We'll wait and review the crossover in its entirety next week when you've had a chance to watch
yes.
it. I have seen the crossover. It's amazing. That's all I'll say about it.
Amazing. I am looking forward to watching it after we get done recording this broadcast here.
Mm-hmm.
I have also not seen Black Lightning. I'm about 3 episodes behind on Black Lightning.
I was going to watch this week's Black Lightning, but then I decided not to in favor of watching the crossover. So no Black Lightning talk on this week's episode.
One day I'll catch up. Soon, mm-hmm. hopefully. Now, let's begin
mm-hmm.
with hour A number 1, which is Arrow. Monday night.
Yep.
Last Monday night. So
yep.
we're a week behind the listening audience here perhaps, but this was an episode that was the follow-up to what we both thought was an all-time classic episode, The Slab Side Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
This one is all about Oliver Queen back in the real world. He is out of prison. He is trying to go back into society, into a society, by the way, that knows that he is the Green Arrow. So his days of wearing a mask and a hood are over because everyone knows who he is. He's also trying to adjust to not being beaten and threatened with assault on a daily basis in prison.
Yeah, he's got a little bit of PTSD here.
Yes, and it's done very subtly, by the way. It's not done in the way that you might expect on one of these shows where they make a big deal out of talking about it. It's just a subtlety in his actions and even, Nick, in the way that he carries himself. Oliver is talking a lot softer. He's carrying himself a lot more timidly than we've seen him in the past. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree with that as well. Yeah, he's a little unsure about how to handle himself, not just because he feels like he has undergone changes in prison, but because he also feels like there have been numerous changes in his supporting cast and the people around him, and he's not really sure how to react to any of those, most notably with his wife, Felicity.
Yes, Felicity, as we noticed in the earlier episodes, she's changing, and she's changing as a result of Oliver's decisions. As she's been assaulted in her home, her stepson was assaulted in their home and nearly killed, and these experiences have changed her and hardened her in many ways because, understandably, she is no longer willing to be a damsel in distress, to be a victim that needs to be saved. She is going to be proactive in the future, and Oliver doesn't know how to react to that because Felicity's always been the one pulling him back from the brink of violence and aggression and pacifying him, and now she is where he has often been, and it's understandably so, in my opinion. So that was a source of conflict in this episode and a source of concern for me going forward, Nick, I have to say, for our favorite CW couple.
Yeah, it is a bit concerning. I'm interested to see how they play with it the rest of the season, especially knowing what we know in the flash forwards about the path that eventually Felicity
yes.
eventually goes down. So lots of things there, but they're doing a good job of keeping me on the edge of my seat with that.
Absolutely. And the crux of this episode was Oliver kind of forging a new identity, a public identity as the Green Arrow, and working officially alongside the Star City PD. He is going to be a deputized member of the PD. They're going to enlist his help in investigations publicly as the Green Arrow. And we also get, of course, as you mentioned, Nick, shots of this future as the dystopian future of Star City starts to come into a little bit more clear picture. We're getting more and more information about that. And then, of course, the big reveal here was the identity of the new Green Arrow that has been patrolling Star City while Oliver was in prison
mm-hmm.
is finally revealed. And, Nick, it is a character that is near and dear to our hearts, one that is has strong ties to the modern Green Arrow comics.
Yeah, she absolutely – that character absolutely does.
He or she. We don't know who.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, I'll say it's a character we didn't see coming. I don't think any of us, you know, either of us, either, you know, ever listed this character on their list of candidates that, the new Green Arrow could potentially be. So, yeah, I liked that reveal. Didn't see it coming, but it was surprising in a good way. So I'm down for it.
And one thing that I didn't mention, and I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, Ricardo Diaz is not dead. Mm-hmm. And there's a decision made by Diggle and Lila in this episode that probably will come back to haunt them later on. What are your – do you have any theories about this underlying mystery that's going on or who might be behind it, Nick?
Well, you're talking about the Knights or about the money, the Dante thing?
The Dante thing. Yeah.
Well, I don't have any theories in the way that you think I do, but I will remind you that Dante was the name of the guy who was running the group, the Ninth Circle, in the recent Ben Percy run of Green Arrow comics. And
I actually wasn't putting that together.
Yeah, and this involves money laundering, as they were talking about. So it could be potentially the Ninth Circle being introduced, is what I'm guessing.
Oh, very interesting. I'm proud of you, Nick. I was expecting you to have a different.
Well, no, because the Dante name is still fresh on my mind, so I instantly went to that. But of course, you know, Dante, you know, past life.
Could be an assumed name, could it not?
Could be an assumed name. And the Ninth Circle, remember, they were disfigured. They hid their faces. So
that's
who
true.
Knows who he could be underneath that mask?
Now. You sound like you're about to start advocating for the firing of one of the members of the Ninth Circle.
Why is that? Why do I sound like that?
Well, when you talk in a certain tone, it seems like you're going to have a TK for someone's firing.
Mm. You know who would actually be a pretty good Dante reveal that isn't Tommy Merlin?
Dante from Clerks.
That would be good as well. Oh, God, what was his name? I've already his name was on the tip of my tongue, and then I forgot it. The character's
Walter?
Name. Walter, yes, would actually be a great Ninth Circle reveal.
Speaking of Walter, we watched a movie over the weekend, David Sunday and Andrew Garner and I, that had Walter in it. Mm-hmm. And what was that movie is a great question that someone could ask me right now. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is quite simple. I don't know. But he was there.
He was there. Doing Walter things.
Doing Walter things.
Looking all black and British.
By God, he's Walter.
Yep.
And certainly he was. Now, he wasn't a major character. He was just a character. But nonetheless, there he was.
Indeed.
Anyway, that aside's gone. And so is that episode of Arrow. Great episode, as has been the norm this season. Excellent stuff. The show just has been firing on all cylinders. Legends of Tomorrow took us to the city of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about you, Nick, but I'll be gone. Oh, damn it. What's the number? Is it gone 500 miles till the day is done?
That is it. I'll be gone. Yes. 500 miles.
100 miles till the day is done.
There it is.
Yep. So took us to New Orleans and gave us a what I thought was a pretty surprising reveal about Constantine, about who this image is that he's been seeing. I've been thinking it was going to be the character from the Constantine TV show that was the fallen angel. But in fact, it's a former lover of Constantine's who he kind of fell in love with in the months before he met the Legends, but whose soul he damned to hell, which is, you know, if you're going to, you know, there are ways to break up with someone, and then, you know, there's damning their soul to hell.
So, I think he did it on accident. It wasn't intentional.
He did it on accident, but you know, come on now.
No, let's be honest, Greg. There are probably breakups that we've both been through where if we had the chance to damn somebody's soul to hell.
Damn your very soul.
You know, we probably would have done it. I'm just saying.
Well, there certainly wasn't no anchor tied to Constantine's ass. That's for sure. So Constantine regrets this very much, and it haunts at him. And this episode's all about Constantine – mostly about Constantine trying to get back or rather save the soul of this lover of his, Desmond. So who also has a trolley at the marketplace. That's a Beatles reference, Nick. Anyway, while that's going on, we also get a plot where Ava and Mick are at odds because, frankly, Ava's kind of a bitch to Mick. And would you not classify it as that?
I would classify it as that, but Mick is also being Mick, and he's something of an acquired taste.
So
I can,
acquired taste, that's
I can,
fair.
I can see both sides.
That's fair. So, and then while all that's going on, the newest character, Mona, is growing romantically attached to a caveman.
Let me tell you something about this Mona thing. I love Legends, Greg. You know I love me
some too.
Legends.
I know where this is going.
No, we gotta. Mona gotta go. Mona and Gary need to just go off and go do Mona and Gary things somewhere else because it's not working for me.
Yep, I did feel bad for Gary though.
I feel bad for Gary as well. And
he's less desirable than a caveman.
But hopefully, in the next episode, Mona will reveal that she loved Gary all along, and they'll go off and ride off into the sunset happily ever after, never to be seen again.
I tend to agree. I don't mind Gary as much as you do, but I liked Mona when she first appeared, and I have gotten less and less interested in her. The big problem with Mona and Gary, Nick, is that whenever they're on screen, they are actively taking time away from the characters that I do care about.
Right, like Nate, for example.
Nate
is getting less screen time than Mona right now, and that's a problem.
Yes, and my mom has been very upset with the season of Legends as a result of Nate's diminishing role, and because he's her favorite character on the show, other than Ray. Ray also has had a lot less to do for most of the season than we're accustomed to, I think. Nonetheless, the Constantine stuff here I thought was really good. The all of the stuff with Mick and Ava was really good. And it was really just the Mona stuff that was kind of dragging it down. And overall, it was not the most exciting episode. I didn't think it was the funniest episode that they've done. So I think this was maybe a little bit of a step down for Legends to me. But still a good episode is all. I mean, their baseline, I think, episode is higher than probably anyone else's other than Arrow's this season.
That's true. But I will say that based on the trailer alone for this week's episode, which we're going to talk about next week, the setup that this episode does looks like it's setting up for one of the best episodes.
Yes.
I was just laughing out loud at the trailer alone. Like, I was like, oh, that's going to be awesome.
I haven't even seen the trailer, but the way that this episode ended on a cliffhanger was awesome. So
yes.
I'm excited to see where it goes. Love this cast. Love this show. And again, I implore you, if you're a listener of this show and you agree with our takes on the CW shows, do what you can to watch Legends and bump the ratings up as much as we can. DVR it, Hulu it, whatever you need to do.
I did read that this past week's Legends got a season high. So
that's great.
Yep.
I hope we can keep those numbers up because the show deserves it. It's a great show, and we need to keep it alive. It's so much fun. Every week is just fun, and we need that in our lives because there's too much not fun out there. Now, on to Tuesday night and the 100th episode of The Flash.
Mm-hmm.
The Flash has been we kind of differed a little bit on The Flash this year. I've been a little down on it, and you have been mostly up on it with the exception of the Cicada subplot.
Right.
Both of us have enjoyed the family stuff, and we've hated the Cicada stuff. And unfortunately, as the season's progressed, Cicada has become a bigger and bigger factor, and thus our enjoyment of the show was waning a little bit. Well, they pumped the brakes on that for this 100th episode, and while Cicada was the overarching threat here that they were going after, he is a very small portion of the episode and only appears near the end in by far the worst part of the episode. And the vast majority of this episode is what I thought, Nick, was easily the best episode.
Oh, not even close in terms of the season, and arguably, and for my money, one of the best episodes they've ever done.
I'm not sure I can go quite to that level just because of the Cicada stuff.
Those first 45 minutes are up there.
Yes.
Like any 45 minutes from
I
any
agree.
Episode that the show's ever done, in my
opinion. I agree. It is a treat for the fans because it is a travel through time to each of the past seasons and villains of The Flash. They have to go back through the timeline to collect items designed to be combined to defeat Cicada and destroy his dagger, his meta dagger, if you will. And in the course of going back through the time stream, Barry and Nora, they encounter past versions of Barry and the rest of the cast. They encounter Savitar. They encounter Zoom, notably, in a great scene where Zoom is able to instantly feel that they are speedsters and chase them through the Speed Force before being grabbed by a speed wraith. So that's all great. All that stuff was awesome. It reminded me, Nick, of how good, kind of enjoyable Zoom was. You know, I kind of missed that villain. And Savitar is there briefly, and the past versions of themselves, obviously. But then the real main event of the episode, I think you would agree, was the return of Eobard Thawne's version of Harrison Wells, as played, of course, by Tom Cavanaugh. Mm-hmm. They encounter him both in the past when he has captured another time-traveling Barry and all the way back at the time of the particle accelerator. They also encounter Gideon. It is amazing. And it reminded me, Nick, in one episode, why The Flash has never found a villain as compelling as Thawne in its entire run. He is just awesome. The way that Cavanaugh plays him, the personal tie that he has to Barry, which is so natural and so believable. Even the scene that we see with Thawne as Wells and Sisko, where he lifts his hand up the same way that he did when he stabbed Sisko in the heart later on, and then it just shakes his hand, you know? Brilliant stuff. There are a lot of mysteries afoot, Nick. I think both of us are very suspicious of Nora at this point.
Yes.
That everything is not as she is saying it is. She clearly has a tie to Eobard Thawne in some regard. I don't know what that regard is. We don't know what the tie to him is, but she knows more about Thawne than she lets on, and Thawne knows more about her than he lets on. So we don't know where this is all going, but it was awesome. I thought it was a great episode. The ending was so exciting, Nick, and is setting up for – they need to just get rid of Cicada right when we come back from the break, do away with that arc, and then let's move on and explore Thawne some more.
Yes, I completely agree. Or more specifically, explore whatever – you know, I don't think Thawne is going to have an active role in the current day storyline for some time, but I am intrigued to see where that goes, and I'm like you. Cicada needs to go off to the side, and let's move forward with that, what they reveal at the end of this episode, and see where it goes.
Yes, and Tom Cavanaugh was just outstanding in this episode.
As he always is.
Yes.
Getting to play three different Wells in this. Gets to play Sherlock,
yes.
Gets to play Harry, and gets to play the version of Thawne as Wells.
Yep, absolutely.
If only we had seen HR as well, that would have been a nice...
Oh, yeah, I do miss HR.
Yep.
I do miss HR. He was a good one. In any event, with that being said, Nick, let's rank them.
Mm-hmm. Arrow Flash Legends. No, Flash Arrow Legends.
I'm going to go... You know what? For the first time this year, I'm going to do it too. I'm going to go Flash Arrow Legends. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very close because I think Arrow was a consistently great episode the whole way through. But the really crappy Cicada scene, which bothered me to no end. I didn't think it made any sense. Them standing there looking like idiots as the dagger comes back down. Didn't like that. But the rest of the episode was so great. I have to give Flash the nod.
Absolutely.
So that's that. That's watching. I have not caught up. I have not yet conversed with the episodes of Titans on which I'm behind. Mm-hmm. I have not yet conversed with anything else, mm-hmm. Nor do I think I have anything else to converse with mm-hmm. comics-wise. What about you, Nick? Have you watched or played anything?
No.
No. Well, football season's almost at an end now, for the most part.
Mostly is, yeah. I've got a few weeks. I've got some vacation time coming up, so looking forward to getting around to that at some point.
Yeah. So, well, with all that being said, I guess that's it for reading and watching.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I'm not even going to bother putting a minute on the clock, Nick, because Raw sucked last week. Really bad. And I have not actually watched SmackDown yet from last week. I've got to watch that. I've got to watch this week's Raw. I've got to watch this week's SmackDown.
But we have the TLC pay-per-view coming up, so we'll have that to talk about next week. So we'll
We'll have Daniel Bryan, AJ Styles, Seth Rollins, and Dean Ambrose, Charlotte, Asuka, and Becky. We got a number. It looks like a pretty loaded card on paper. Although you have to wonder with 12 matches, I think now on the card or whatever it is, that's a lot.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it though.
Indeed. All right. Well, hearing no objections, next week we will be back with our look at Aquaman by Peter David.
Mm-hmm.
Then we will come back the next week, I believe, Nick, if I'm not mistaken, with our exclusive review of the Aquaman motion picture, assuming I am able to see it.
Mm, that would be nice. And
that would be a good thing to do. I agree. But there are familial complications. Mm. So it should be able to happen, but we'll see. And if not, we can get Nick Duke's exclusive review of the film. So with all that being said, anything else, Nick?
No, I guess that's about it. But we closed this week, as we have done for some time now, with a little musical interlude from one Jim Ross. And you know, Greg, you opened the episode with a little holiday cheer. And so week, JR is actually going to be joined. I have an exclusive reveal here, Greg, that you're not even aware of. He's going to be joined by a special guest here. Because JR is going to sing you a little holiday time song, and it's about the time that he was trapped, snowed in North Carolina with 16-time world heavyweight champion Ric Flair. So here, for the first time ever on the Hard Traveling Fanboys, we have not one, but two WWE Hall of Famers here to present you with an old holiday standard, ladies and gentlemen.
They're doing it, Nick, on the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Here, ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Jim Ross and the Nature Boy, Ric Flair.
Good Lord. All right, now, Rick, get yourself sober. Get ready here. You ready? You ready? All right, now. I really can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I have got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has been
hoping you'd drop in. Yeah, that's what I said.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hands. Well, they're just like ice. You know, like Iceman Dean Malenko. He was a horseman.
My mother would take me to the store, and I would start to worry.
Beautiful Jim Ross, what's your hurry?
My father will be pacing the floor with a bag of puppies.
Listen to that fireplace roar. You know who else roared? Saba Simba. Yeah, it was Tony Atlas. Yeah, you know, he's broken destitute now. I don't know if you knew that, Jim.
So, really sounds, not to interrupt you, Rick, but it sounds like I'd better just scurry on along, get out of here like a scalded dog.
Beautiful, beautiful. Please, though, don't hurry. Don't hurry on my account.
But maybe just half a drink more.
Now you're talking my language. Let's put some records on while I pour.
But the neighbors might think,
baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what is in this drink?
Well, there's no carbs here, no cabs either. None to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Well, your eyes, they're like starlight now. Now, granted, one of them's closed, but still.
To break this spell.
Hey, here, give me your Resistol hat, Jim. Your hair looks swell.
I ought to say, no, no,
No, sir.
You mind if I move a little closer?
At least I'm going to say that I tried.
What's the sense in hurting my pride? I told you, you know, Bret Hart never drew any money. You know who drew money? Me. Harley. Those are the guys that drew money. I remember Jack Mulligan. Jack Mulligan and I sold out the Charlotte Coliseum in 10 hours. 10 hours!
Well, quite frankly, that's really not for me to say.
Oh, baby, don't hold out now. You got the numbers.
But, Rick, it is cold outside. I simply must go.
But, Jim, it's cold outside.
The answer is no.
But, baby, it's cold outside.
Your welcome has been...
Well, how lucky I am that you dropped in.
So nice and warm.
But look out the window, Jim. It's dawn.
My sister, Dawn, will be suspicious with your...
Gosh, your lips look delicious. Easy for me to say.
My brother will be there at the door with Dan Hodge.
Waves upon a tropical shore. That's what there was going on when I got my first Hodge job. Yeah, Danny Hodge, you grabbed me right by the groin. You know, you were there.
I know, Rick. My maiden aunt's mind is vicious.
Gosh, your lips are delicious.
But maybe just a cigarette more. I tried to quit last year, but I haven't had much success.
Well, never seen such a blizzard before. Unless you count the blizzard of cocaine that Barry Windham snorted off that hooker's ass.
You know, I've got to get home.
But, Jim, you'd freeze out there.
Say, lend me your coat.
It's up to your knees out there.
You've really been grand.
Oh, I thrill when you touch my hand.
But don't you see...
How can you do this thing to me?
There's bound to be talk tomorrow on the internet. A bunch of Richards on Twitter typing their little words on the internet saying, oh, JR and Rick are having a relationship together. Oh, what is it their business?
I know, but think of my lifelong sorrow. Every friend I've had either is dead or sick or has no teeth.
Well, at least there will be plenty implied.
Well, what if you got pneumonia and died, just like Ricky Morton?
I really can't stay, and Ricky's still alive.
You need to get over that fact. He's going to die eventually. We all do.
Baby, it's cold.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I believe it was quite sudden, and thank you.
Our traveling fanboys.